Hey, it's Kyle Meredith, host of the Kyle Meredith With podcast, presented by WFPK at WFPK.org and the Consequence Podcast Network. It's a series that puts the spotlight on iconic musicians and actors, inviting them to drop by and talk about their latest projects, whether it's albums, TV shows, films, or beyond.
I'm going to say something I don't want to say. Here it goes. Without Spinal Tap, there is no Tenacious D.
Whoa. Man.
We get great stories and the biggest scoops from people like Garbage's Shirley Manson, the 1975's Matty Healy, Jack Black and Kyle Gass of Tenacious D, Maya Hawke, Kiefer Sutherland, and everyone in between. New episodes arrive every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, so it's a great way to keep up with your favorite artists and discover some new ones. You can find Kyle Meredith With on the Consequence Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hey, you. Have you checked out my book, In Defense of Ska, yet? It was one of Rolling Stone's top recommended picks in June of 2021. Esquire magazine called it an excellent read, and GQ said that it was an intelligent look at the much maligned genre and its various waves. So what are you waiting for? Get yourself a copy of In Defense of Ska right now at clashbooks.com. Last year, Max Collins, the lead singer of Eve 6, confessed on Twitter to being a virgin when he wrote his huge 90s alt-rock single, Inside Out. Twitter went crazy. The very next day, Twitter account Ska or Nah asked him if he liked Ska. He replied no. But then, when Ska Twitter pushed back, Max did something he would never do in the coming months as he became the go-to Twitter account for hot takes. He changed his position to yes. It turns out that Max, our guest today, was a ska fan in the 90s and continues to like certain groups, including We Are the Union and Operation Ivy, which might explain why all of a sudden Eve 6 and We Are the Union dropped a surprise cover of Op Ivy's classic ska song, Sound System, which I can only assume at this point has broken the internet.
Did you think, Aaron, when we started this podcast, that we would end up talking to the singer of Eve 6?
Nope. Had no idea. I'd actually been trying to get him on the podcast for a while. And, you know, I wasn't sure if it was ever going to happen.
Yeah, his Twitter presence is so funny. And just kind of some of the asides that he'll post about ska are hilarious.
Oh, yeah. I love it when he goes on a ska tangent.
So, yeah, I think it was a pretty great opportunity for us to get to talk to him and to find out that the singer from Eve 6 likes ska.
Yeah, he likes ska and, as is now known, has a ska song collaboration with We Are the Union. So just the stars aligned and he joined In Defense of Ska to talk about his ska project.
One more soldier in the army to create a Operation Ivy reunion.
By the time this releases, your song with We Are the Union will have already released. So what do you think? Let's predict. How do you think people are going to react to this?
Well, I think it's going to be extremely polarizing, as it should be. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, I mean, you know, Operation Ivy is in that canon of bands that you ought not cover, which is, you know, of course, I think with, I don't know, that is what made it appealing to me, just being Irish and contrarian and getting a kick out of leaning into all of this stuff of late. Yeah, I think there people will be genuinely furious. Some will be, and I think it'll be mocked and derided. You know, I think Reed and I will be doing the march, you know, the Stations of the Cross, being mercilessly flogged and spat upon. And then I think others will love it, because I think the spirit of the song is there. We had a really good time doing it. And one of the things I love about the record is that it sounds terrible. And by that, I mean, it sounds great. Like, I love that it sounds terrible. But like, I do think for some, maybe like Zoomers or whatever, who haven't heard the song before and wouldn't know what to do with the production value of the original, might find themselves receptive to the song and then be able to appreciate the original after the fact. I don't know. I'm totally spitballing here.
The original is like the perfect example of good, bad recording. It's just perfect example of that. It's just so good in how bad it was recorded.
And like, which is so refreshing to hear now when our ears are so like, so trained to, you know, so much stuff we listen to is just smacked straight to a grid and tuned and everything else. And like, the looseness of that record, verging on absolute chaos, like is part of what makes it great. You know, I mean, there's just enough control going on to keep it from completely flying off the rails.
Yeah.
Our version is much more controlled. It's, you know, we were in no way trying to recapture, you know, the recording, but do justice to the song, in as much as we could, and really just have a good time doing it and not troubling ourselves too much with what perceptions or critiques might be, and honestly having a good time with the potential of that too. So that's kind of where I think we both were with it. And it was her idea. She reached out to me to do the song, and I didn't know anything about We Are the Union at the time, other than they'd done a tweet that one of the new Eve Six songs called I Want to Bite Your Face was like a Ramones song, but better than the Ramones or something like that, which I like quote tweeted, and then got a bunch of people mad at me for that, for even quote tweeting it. Like Titus Andronicus literally DM'd me. He was like, dude, come on, man. You can't fucking be real. You know, like, yeah. So I guess it was that was kind of the perfect precursor to us deciding to cover Operation Ivy.
I remembered you tweeting that nobody should cover Operation Ivy. And literally the next day, Brent from We Are the Union texts me and says, we're recording an Operation Ivy song with the guy from Eve Six.
Yeah. That was fun for me. And I'll probably do more stuff like that later.
That's your marketing campaign.
Yeah, exactly.
Just shit on the idea first and then do the idea.
And then do it. Yeah, like really, really go in hard on it. Like it, you know, it's morally wrong to do. Here are the reasons why.
And then do it.
And then do it. Yeah.
You know who's gonna love this cover, though. This is all the ska people, all the ska fans and all the ska bands are just going to love it.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah, you're more familiar with them than I am, but just in the interactions that I've had with a lot of them online, I think you're right. I mean, their attitude is just so good. It's their attitude is so ska, frankly. You know, yeah. It's just like, yeah. So I think they'll get a kick out of it, out of the strangeness of it all.
If you were going into a recording studio and you wanted the Operation Ivy guitar sound, what would you try to tell the engineer to get that sound?
That's a great question. And I was there for some of the guitar overdubs that Reed did, and it was like basically like, you know, simulating going direct or going direct, you know. It's just, it sounds like, for that clean sound, it really sounds like it's just direct with absolutely nothing on it. Yeah, it's like tinny to the point where any more tinniness would be like literally painful. It's like just below,
yeah,
just below the greatest possible, you know, misery you could feel from a tone. It's like just below that level.
I interviewed the Kevin Army, who was the engineer on that record, and he's like, he ended up doing like Mr. T Experience and some Green Day, so he kind of became really well known as a punk engineer. But he was telling me that when he was building up his resume and he would put together the different stuff he'd worked on, you know, I had a little bit of Op Ivy on there, and he said he would show that to like label people or whatever, and they would just laugh at him when it got to Ivy. Because it was like, to them, it was like, oh, this is horrible. Why are you showing us this?
Yeah, that type of bug-brained person could never understand it. And that's part of what's so great about it.
Yeah.
Is that, yeah, it weeds out the fucking nerds. Because in order to appreciate it, you have to really be able to appreciate the spirit of rock and roll. And like, those fuckers don't know how to do that, you know?
No.
That's beautiful.
So you're also playing Fest this year.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure I know the whole story because I watched it play out on Twitter, but tell us how that came about.
Yeah. It was a sort of protracted campaign by me to I sort of got on this topic a few months prior where I was just saying I really thought it would be like not just hilarious but valid like performance art to go and do a tour with a band like Lamb of God, or like basically a band that would get us not just heckled but like but like attacked, like you know, so that was just a funny concept to me. And then I think I may have been prompted with Fest by someone saying we should play Fest or something like that. And then I tagged Fest and I just stated my case. I was like, you know, this would be the summit of entertainment value, especially if it goes south, you know,
like, yeah.
So and whoever runs their social media is very good at it, and immediately I think saw an opportunity, so we kind of volleyed back and forth until I got the email address of Tony the promoter, and I wrote to him and was like, you know, don't be a coward, you know? And, and he was into it. So yeah, we're playing Fest.
Was it okay? I think I remember like one of your ideas or one of your pitches was like, put us after the Gorilla Biscuits. Like that was like the whole, am I remembering that right?
You're totally remembering that right.
Yeah.
You're reminding me of that. Yeah. I was just thinking like, yeah, set us up for the most extreme possible failure. Like that's, you know, that's the way to do it. And then Gorilla Biscuits dropped off And I think we're playing really early, which is also great. Like, I don't know if we're playing before anyone or after anyone, but yeah, I mean, it's just wonderful. Like, this is the kind of shit that I want to be doing right now, which is just doing the most unlikely shit possible. And yeah, I sound like an asshole when I talk like this, but like, it kind of exploring opportunities for what I perceive to be performance art even when it's just sort of an exposure of some kind of absurdity or something like that. Like, that's what the Twitter account is. And it's you know, as we all know, the online to IRL pipeline is real.
Yeah. I love that you're just embracing chaos, because I feel like that's needed, especially as live music returns. Because I remember even before COVID, it was like everyone's on their phone.
Mm-hmm.
Bands are playing very predictable sets. Bands are playing with very predictable bands, and the audience, you know, even though they're paying all this money to go see it, they don't even seem like they're really enjoying it, because nothing is like pulling them in the moment.
Yeah, completely. And you know, you can see why people in the industry like get stuck in these like in these grooves where, you know, deviating from like the most normative path is like scary. And I got that from our booking agents, who are great, and who I've kind of proven my insanity to them, but my insanity has some utility to them, so they are open to some of these ideas now. But when I first brought up the concept before Fest or whatever of Eve Six going out with like a hardcore band whose audience would hate us, they were like, yeah, that's funny, but you know, I think it would be a hard sell to promoters, because you know, promoters aren't going to understand. It's like, we'll make them understand, you know, like make them understand that this is like an opportunity for them to like get in on and manipulate a strange little zeitgeist moment. And you know, and I'm not saying any of this in some self-important way, like the bit is that it's Eve Six, like that's what's funny. But yeah, I think everyone is fucking risk averse, and you know, you really have to like you know, evangelize like a zealot to kind of get people to bend away from what's normal.
At Fest, is Eve Six gonna cover Gorilla Biscuits?
Yeah.
Right. I forgot I said that. So yeah, now we have to. This is good. You guys are reminding me of some stuff. Yeah. I remember I asked Twitter what songs we should do, and got some responses, some of which were like, seemed really appropriate. So I should go back and appropriate in their inappropriateness. I should go back and search that. Yeah, definitely doing that. Definitely doing sound system with We Are the Union. I'm flying in a day early for their set. And we're also going to have Virginity, who they're another band who's playing Fest. And when we released the new Eve Six EP, like one of the songs, the last song in the EP, was mistakenly an instrumental version of the song. It was like a distributor error. And I was like, oh, this is fucking great, you know? And then that thought was quickly supplanted with, okay, fucking, you know, this is an opportunity. And I put it out on Twitter, like, if anyone wants to record their own song, any band wants to record their own song over this track, do it. If it's good, we'll release it as a collab. And Virginity did that, and of course made a much better song than the original. So they're going to come up and do that version of the song with us at Fest as well.
Oh, nice.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had a question. I was I'm blanking out for a second here.
No worries. I feel like people don't like, there's a similar thing in podcasts where like podcast people are afraid to have like silence and unedited moments and stuff. And I love podcasts that are like that. Like, I think it's great. Like, I want to hear ambient sound and like, you know, brain fart moments and shit like that. It's like, yeah, put me there.
Get a little room tone going.
Yeah.
Back in the 90s, you know, and definitely in the 80s too, but back in the 90s when I was, you know, going to shows and playing shows, mixed bills were the norm. Like the industry has gotten better and better, which has made it worse in terms of like, so, but I love that. I would love if we went back to that where it's like, you have bands from different genres filling out the bill, not just all the same sounding band.
Totally. Totally, man. Like, one of the first shows I ever saw was Korn opening for The Offspring opening for Pennywise. I guess Offspring and Pennywise could be placed in the same milieu pretty easily, but like, yeah, Korn. Yeah, and I mean, that was a bigger bill. And then, yeah, smaller bills like all ages shows and stuff would be insanely eclectic, you know?
Yeah. Like, and when my ska band used to play, you know, we did punk tours back in like the mid 90s before ska got super big. And we rarely ever played with ska bands just because we played with whoever we could get shows with. And it was usually punk bands or alternative rock bands or whatever. That's just what was there. And it was rad. It was always rad to be the only ska band on the bill, because then it's like, we didn't wear, the audience wasn't worn out to the music. It was like, oh, cool, this is a different thing. I'll
totally
give them my. And then one time, we ended up on this festival, like this, and by festival, I mean like it was at a park for 50 people in a gazebo, and every other band was like gothy synth pop, right? And
yeah.
It was super weird and uncomfortable, but like the audience bought more merch from us than any other show, because like a lot of them never even heard of this music before.
Yeah.
They were just totally blown away. And we were like really uncomfortable. We're like, oh, fuck, this is going to be our worst show ever. And, but we just, you know, we played.
Dude, I could see that being like a best case scenario for ska, because like you're dealing with its tonal and aesthetic opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's going from like, you know, gloom wallowing to like, you know, maniacal joy. And then that probably just made it even more potent, the joy.
Well, what was funny is they all stared at us the entire time, like deer with their like caught in headlights. Entire
they
show.
They literally didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, when we finished, I was like, okay, let's pack up. Let's get out of here. I do not want to be here. And then they all flocked to our merch booth and they just started buying all our tapes and shirts. I was like, whoa, this is crazy. Cause they were like processing it. And then they were like, this is cool.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Has Eve Six ever played any super mismatched shows?
Yeah, in different contexts, because I mean,
what jumps out to you?
Well, our second record came out during, you know, the nu metal heyday, and yeah. We had made a very standard tuning pop rock record with like synths on it and stuff. And And it went to alternative radio, just like Papa Roach, Kid Rock, Limp Bizkit, everything else. So the bills that we found ourselves on were bills like that. And yeah, it was insane. You know, it was crazy. And then
did the audience hate you, or did you win them over?
No, they hated us. Yeah. Like the worst one was a show in Phoenix, I think, like a radio festival with all of those bands, and the audience had gotten a hold of bags of ice somehow. So they were throwing like the normal, you know, plastic beer bottles or whatever. And then also throwing ice, and one of the pieces of ice caught me above the eye, like mid set. So my eye starts bleeding. I have like blood running down my face as we're doing, you know, like Here's to the Night or whatever. It was like, in hindsight, it's amazing and hilarious, but yeah, it was a total nightmare. And then the flip of that was the third single off of that record didn't even go to rock radio. It went only to pop radio. So then we found ourselves playing shows with like the Baha Men and you know, whatever Britney Spears knockoff was going on and stuff like that.
Did those audiences, I feel like those audiences might give you a shot.
Yeah, those audiences were a little more receptive. Yeah, I mean, the heaviest band on the bill always has like the advantage, because in that context we were the heaviest band on the bill.
So yeah, I mean, I'm happy to hear that you're bringing this back. You this is your mission for the post-COVID world. We're going to bring back mixed bills, weird surprises, and just a little bit of chaos.
Yes,
to live music.
We had Laura Jane Grace on board for this, but we got to test where you are on this. How do you feel about an Operation Ivy reunion?
I mean, I just want them to do it. Like, I don't know what Jesse's, you know, financial situation is or whatever. But I want them to be able to get that money, you know? Yeah. I mean, like, he deserves it. And you know, they all deserve it. Like that's sort of my first take, I guess. And then I also think, I mean, it would be just sick to see it happen. Like I personally wouldn't be measuring it against like some YouTube video of one of their first shows or something. I would just like appreciate the fact that I was getting to witness this thing that meant so much to me as a kid, that you know, I would put that record on and just dream. It was like an opening to another world that was like strange and unfamiliar, and like, yeah, to be able to see that happen, even if it demystified a little bit, I think would be like precious, you know.
Definitely.
Yeah.
What was Laura Jane Grace's take?
She wants it to happen really bad.
She's campaigning very, yeah, very aggressively to make it happen.
Okay. Yeah.
So last year, December 19th, I looked this up. No, December 18th is when you tweeted that you were a virgin when you wrote Inside Out.
Yeah.
Great tweet, by the way.
Thank you.
This is the moment that you kind of got like started getting a lot of attention on Twitter.
Yeah.
So the next day, there was another important tweet, and that's when the account Scott or Nah asked you if you like ska.
Right.
And you said no.
Yeah. Look, I knew you guys weren't gonna play softball the whole time, you know. So this is okay. And you know, I'm gonna negotiate this right now. So first of all, I wasn't, you know, a year ago, I wasn't like new to Twitter. I've been on Twitter for a long time, but not as a poster, like as someone who would like, you know, follow the journalists I like and the, you know, a couple comedians, bands, whatever kind of thing. And yeah, so I wasn't aware of like this groundswell, this like this, you know, new like burgeoning summer of ska thing happening. I was just not on my radar at all. So I started to get like a multitude of replies apropos of nothing talking about ska. And so my initial reaction was to bat it down. And I was also like, that was the craziest. That first month was like extra crazy because I just wasn't like, I've gotten better at being able to kind of compartmentalize the Twitter thing and put it down a little bit, not as much as I should, but a little better. It was straight up like jacking my nervous system. So I was like, I was erring on the side of hostility, basically, I would say.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, very much choosing chaos, very much choosing antagonism. Yeah, so my actual thoughts or experiences with ska, mid-90s, very much went through a ska phase that was started by Operation Ivy. I don't even think I knew what ska was until I got the 12-inch Operation Ivy record. And I don't even know what put that on my radar, if it was just I was at the record store and the cover was cool or what. Sorry, I'm putting ice in the glass, so we're going to have some nice ambient noise here. This is great. This is ASMR. We would charge listeners. Isn't this lovely? And I was like, whoa, this is so strange and so cool. And yeah, I would just listen to that record all the time. That led me to some other stuff. Predictably, I guess the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, this would have been pre-hit, you know?
Yeah.
I had the record that was plaid vinyl, which was sick. I think it was a double 10-inch. Or maybe it was just one 10. I want to say it was a 10-inch record. I had that. I had a Toasters record on vinyl. You know, I got into Less Than Jake, went and saw them at this place where my band would play in high school all the time. And I talked with Chris, right? Is the singer?
Yeah, that's the singer.
Yeah, I talked with Chris about that when I did his podcast. I always forget the name of the place. Cobalt Cafe, I think. Went and saw them there. So yeah, I ska definitely played an important part in my kind of finding myself as a teenager, like musically and stuff. If I do like under the wrong conditions, like ska doesn't automatically take me to the place. Take me to the ska utopia. Like it can, if I'm in the wrong frame of mind, feel like too much mania, and it can kind of yeah, make me bristle a little bit with antagonism. That's true. But it's been years since I put on a record that could even like, you know, be considered attendant to ska or whatever. It wasn't till recently that I listened to that Operation Ivy record again. It was just like, couldn't stop listening to it. Made my kids listen to it. And yeah, kind of rediscovered it. So yeah, I guess when it comes to ska, I'm a bit of a centrist, you know?
Sure. I love the part, though. The part I love is that when people started replying to you, you said, okay, like you convinced me, I like ska. And then,
yeah.
And then you posted that IV6 would make a ska record.
Yeah. That might actually be the only, the only hot take that I've walked back, may have been that. And I think part of it was probably just the charm of the ska people. I mean, the ska people, yeah, they come on strong, but underneath it, they're also lovely and have a sense of humor. So I think that that warmed me pretty quickly to the online ska community.
Yeah. The current state of the ska scene and the ska community online, I think, is one that has been built over years and years and years of just people making fun of the music and the subculture to the point where I think people have been like, kind of, they just like push back in a way that they didn't for decades.
Yeah, right, right. Like the, yeah, the inevitable kind of bully dynamic where it's like, no, fuck you, I'm going to stand my ground here, ska's good.
Basically, yeah. It's a friendly pushback.
With everything ska, there's like, there's that spirit of joy there, which is great, which is like, you know, disarms the haters and also it puts good into the world.
Mm-hmm. So one of the people that commented on that was somebody I know that was in the Toasters back in the day. And they said that you, or the word is that you trashed the Toasters limo at some point. Is this a true story?
Dude, I hope so. did we get any more info?
That's all I got.
Oh my God. Trash the Toasters limo. I mean, I don't remember ever being in the vicinity of the Toasters, and I would, because like I said, they were one of the few ska bands that was like I owned a record by. Yeah, but that said, you know, I did an awful lot of drinking and you know, hell raising and all that, so it's not out of the realm of possibility. I just you know,
can't remember. Okay.
Yeah, I don't recall.
Why did the Toasters have a limo though?
That's the part about it I'm not sure. They were rich on ska books in 1995.
I guess.
did they, yeah, what was their like career arc like? Like when they were at their biggest, what did that look like?
Their career went up and down multiple times. Some of that was because of multiple lineup changes, because those guys date back to like 1981.
Right.
And then they would kind of, they would make some progress and then they would lose key members and then they would sort of start over and then they would build up again. And then also that guy started Moon Records. So he was dealing with Moon Records. They were almost signed to Mercury, but that fell apart. This was like 95.
Okay.
So, yeah. So anyways.
Yeah. That's gotta be the hardest part. Like it's hard enough to keep a 3-piece band together, let alone like an 11-piece band or like some of these that have like, you know, full horn sections and all that.
Did you, Eve Six, ever play with ska bands?
Yes, we definitely did shows with Real Big Fish. I feel like we did one even, I mean, a long time ago still now, but not as long ago as you might think, like in the 2010s or something.
Mm-hmm.
We did a tour with Goldfinger. It depends how broad you want to be with the term, I guess, but like we did a tour with Goldfinger. Who else? I'm sure we did shows with the Boss Tones because they had that hit like around the time that we did. So I'm sure we would have ended up on festivals with them.
Yeah, like the radio showcase sort of deals.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, that's again what I'm saying is like people nowadays, like it seems strange to ask that and hear your answer, but that was just the norm back then. It wasn't,
yeah,
it wasn't a big deal. Like bands who were in different genres played with ska bands all the time. It was, you know, and vice versa, punk bands, all that stuff.
Yeah, completely. Completely. And even at the level of like commercial radio rock at the end of the 90s, there was a smorgasbord of like things going on. There were all kinds of different sounds, like wildly different sounds and different types of bands. You know, it was homogenous in its own way, because maybe like you could definitely pinpoint like a type of radio rock, I guess, but I don't know. It was always being subverted by something else.
There was room for different things to be added to that mixture too, or to be taken away. I think that was part of it that was interesting. Whereas, yeah, now things are more algorithm based, it seems like.
Completely.
So what you were talking earlier about the sort of, you know, wanting to bring a little chaos to live music and how your bookers are kind of reluctantly with you. It's not just a joke. It also kind of like works, right? Because like it kind of jars people out of the lull. But
yeah,
like you were saying that your Twitter is kind of evidence of that. And I think this is a great point. Like your Twitter is an example of probably how like a social media marketing class would tell you not to behave with your professional social media.
Yeah.
Yet you've kind of taken over Twitter because of it. Like you've, like it's definitely worked in your favor. Like,
yeah,
behaving the way you're not supposed to behave. Like being chaotic and being surprising people and just not doing things in the appropriate marketing way. Like, I think that's cool. And that's really interesting about where we're all at right now. Like, and I think we all want that in all these different areas of our life.
Yeah. I think we want to buck against, just like temperature controlled everything, just neoliberal gray. Like we want some fucking beauty, and and I think to what you said, like, yeah, there are social media, like there are brands that try to sort of simulate chaos and sort of do it in a cynical way. But then you also use the word surprise, and I feel like that has been the thing that there's a Twitter account called like Falcon. Do you follow the Falcon guy?
I'm not familiar. No.
All right. Well, he's like literally a madman, and he's a fantastic poster. And he just does these posts about Falcons, and he sells like that. He sells like Falcons from Dubai or whatever. Like he's out of his mind, but then he'll also do like really cogent analysis. He's a trip, and he's anonymous. I still don't know who this guy is, even though I've like DM'd him and stuff like that. And I watched his Twitter account go from when he first started like replying to me with like crazy shit. He had like 42 followers or something, and now he's got like 20 or 40,000 or something like that. He did this like analysis of the Eve6 Twitter account, and it was really like accurate, I think. And it was basically like, you know, you never condescend. Like,
yeah,
you never condescend. You know, it's like I remember the author. This is great because now I'm comparing Twitter to literature. But the author, Jeffrey Eugenides, who wrote Middlesex and The Virgin Suicides, he had something about writing where he was like, you know, write like you're writing a letter to your smartest friend. Like, don't condescend. And that can be alienating to people, but the people who that's alienating to are not the people that you need to concern yourself with. It's everyone else who's going to find joy in it. So, and I think most Twitter accounts are, yeah, in the business of just wanting to, you know, cynically accrue more followers and probably try to only say things that they think a lot of people will agree with or whatever.
Yeah.
There's of course, the other end of the spectrum is just being like, you know, like edgelord or contrarian to the point where where it's also dishonest and becomes completely uninteresting. Like that's not interesting to me either. But, I feel like that's what kind of earned me some trust or something. And I think people also just have a really good time engaging with it because it is collaborative. Like I riff with anyone and everyone who's good at riffing. Like I do not prioritize blue checks. In fact, it's the opposite. Like, so yeah, I think there's a spirit of collaboration about it. It's also fun for people, but it's definitely fun for me.
Do you have anyone pushing back against you saying to chill out? I mean, I know you, Eve6 is self-managed, right? So
yeah,
you don't have anyone standing over you, but like, does anybody like freak out at all about your Twitter presence?
No, I think that's another sort of good thing about the position that we were coming from, which was that we really didn't have anything to lose. We had just done a record deal with, you know, an independent label, but like, we weren't dealing with corporations or anyone who's being, yeah, anyone who's being, you know, funded by anyone I might be attacking online or anything like that. So, and then, it kind of started working immediately, and stuff started going viral and all of that, which, yeah, absolutely has helped the band. I mean, like, there's no question about it. It's, you know, it's been like this weird little, you know, fucking, I don't know what you call it, weird little renaissance thing in certain spaces, and that's definitely served the band. So I think the, you know, people at the label are like, great, you know, this is fine with us. I think it could be problematic if we were like, yeah, I mean, you definitely don't see artists on major labels, you know, saying like Free Palestine very often or whatever. You know, like we're unencumbered by all of that shit because we're coming from a place we came from a place of being completely marginal, you know. Mm-hmm. and that's the soul of the bit too.
Mm-hmm. yeah and you came back with this EP, Grim Value. I mean, you'd already recorded that though, right? That was recorded like a year earlier.
Yes.
That EP, I really like that EP. And I think it, like, you releasing that as this was all sort of happening, and it's like, oh, they got good new music too. It was like, it was so cool and interesting to see.
Thank you.
That you were offering something artistically as well as what was happening on Twitter.
Yeah, we have a whole record recorded. We recorded it as a full length originally. I think we're going to put it out as two EPs. And we're going to put out the first single in November. And then the plan is to release a song a month for a year on the eve of the 6th of every month.
Yeah.
So we're definitely like, I mean, I feel like we have in that department a lot to prove to people, because yeah, we've taken way too many fucking long hiatuses, and there are plenty of boring reasons for that. But we're in a place right now, John and I, where yeah, we find ourselves completely unencumbered by you know, any opinions that might try to, you know, put obstacles in our path of doing exactly what we want. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't always the case, and now it's the case. So yeah, so we're making music like crazy, and yeah, I did originally start to tweet from the Eve6 account just to let people know that like we were still a band again, and we're going to be active and going to be putting some music out, you know. So you know, there was an agenda, there just wasn't any expectation that it was gonna turn into what it turned into, you know?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I want to hear more about I Want to Bite Your Face, the song that critics are describing as better than Ramones. So, no, I really that's my favorite song on the EP as well. I would love to hear a little bit about you know, where that song came from, and you know, just a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's funny you say that, because I do think, I mean, it's not ska at all, but if any song on the EP could be interpreted as a ska song, it would be that one, you know. I think for me, like during the time of the writing of that EP, I was in a new relationship. I've never really written love songs. I've always just kind of been, I don't know, not been able to or something like that. But I found myself wanting to describe the sentiment, but in a way that like actually feels like the feeling and like has like visceral elements and stuff. And because so often like love songs are like virtue signaling, to be honest. They're it's like more about, you know, more about the person singing the song wanting to present as something to another. And which doesn't have anything to do, like, that's not actually a love song, like that's something else. You know, our favorite problematic guy, Morrissey, was like expert at that, you know, like turning a phrase, like turning the macabre into, you know, romance, basically. And so I was kind of, I think, taking a page from that tradition a little bit. And I don't know, I heard the track that John had made, and I Want to Bite Your Face, just that lyric popped into my head right away. And I was like, all right, I'm going to see if I can make this a love song. And yeah, that's what I did, I guess.
Yeah. I love it. I Want to Bite Your Face as a sentiment of love.
Like, yeah,
it's great.
Yeah, I mean, and that's like, that stuff is like so indelibly in like the psyche. It's like, I want to eat you up, you know. It's like, it's in there. We have this like weird like latent cannibalism thing happening.
Now, not only do you have like, you know, controversial takes about music on your Twitter, there was one moment where you had this, you were going on about basically defending like mediocre rock bands.
Yeah.
You know, you were trying to explain the value that they had, which I really loved, because I feel like you were getting at something that was what I get at a lot, especially with my book, is that all this, you know, 90s ska that people wrote off, like, definitely doesn't, the critics don't care for it. Like music people hate it. But it has value to people, and why is its value diminished by other people? And I feel like, you know, that was kind of what you were getting at too. It's like all this lost, you know, music the critics don't care about, that whatever is not like the great stuff that's remembered, is like it has or had value to people. So
yeah, you just said it better than I could probably. I mean, like that's totally it. And that doesn't mean that there's not fucking a place for the avant-garde, and that we don't need more of it, and that people shouldn't constantly be deconstructing and, you know, and pissing on norms and coming up with new ideas. Like, that's all great. I think the starting premise for me was like, you know, well, first of all, like, if it brings you pleasure, then like remove the guilt. Like, first examine that for like 2 seconds and realize that it's absurd. Like,
yeah,
if you like a thing and you derive you know, joy from it, or, you know, melancholy or whatever other feeling that you respond to favorably, or a thing just catches you vulnerable and you don't know why, and but it does, and it's a thing that other people like to make fun of, who cares? Like, that's a thing that you like. That's not a guilty pleasure. That's a pleasure. And so starting there and then moving into, you know, it's like, yeah, we've all been served up these lazy fucking, you know, music journalism pieces, you know, lists of the best songs of, you know, 2000, whatever, or all of that stuff where it's like, you're sort of being told what's acceptable to like, and what's not acceptable to like. And so it's pushing back on that whole thing, which is at its essence, like snobby, and even verges on classism. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think that's an overstatement. Like the fact that I do think in not all cases, but in a lot of cases, taste is a choice, and that, you know, you can listen to something, you can make a decision to have an objective listen on something sometimes and decide to see what's good about it. And maybe by doing that, it starts to work on you. That's one possibility. And then the other possibility is like, this happened for me with the Goo Goo Dolls. It's like, you know, Goo Goo Dolls, I've had firmly in that, you know, in that camp of bands that don't matter, that, you know, I don't care about at all, corporate radio rock, just wholly uninteresting, blah, blah, blah. And then like you're standing in line at CVS or whatever, and Black Balloon comes on and you hear it and it's a completely new song, and you realize the source of it. You realize it's the Replacements, you know, you realize that it's like, you know, it's been written off as fashion, basically, like nothing more. And so, yeah, that those are also endlessly fun conversations to have, because I think there's just truth in it. And yeah, it like riles people up, feel like, you know, you know, you have to love Radiohead and you have to hate Nickelback. I mean, that's like, that's your starting point for your average, like, bug-brained music, you know, fair-weather music person. And it's like, oh, you know, why?
I was never a Goo Goo Dolls fan, but my very first assignment as a music journalist was back in 2009, was to go review one of their concerts. I found a friend of mine who was really into them, and I brought him. And yeah, I could, you know, I mean, it was to see his reaction to them and how excited he got.
Yeah.
Really helped me to be able to see what was good about them and to appreciate them in a way I hadn't appreciated them before, as somebody who I didn't necessarily, I wouldn't say I hated them. They were just kind of what you described, like, just, I just wrote them off. I just didn't really pay attention to them.
Yes. Yeah, completely. And I think there's something in all of us too. It's like, it's in me too. It's like, and you even see it with this, you know, the stuff I was talking about on Twitter today, where it's like, it just seems like people want to give musicians an extra hard time, mm-hmm. for playing shows right now. Shows that observe current COVID protocols and everything else, but like, you know, their people get, it seems to me, asymmetrically pissed off at musicians, you know, who need to keep the lights on and who aren't, like, you know, doing anything, that aren't going against the CDC or whatever. And then you have like these, you know, sporting events in massive stadiums where like no one's wearing masks and no one's really seems to be giving those multimillionaires a hard time. So it's like, there's this kind of sadomasochistic thing that I feel like people have with musicians who gain some level of success. And maybe some of that is the fact that it's like, okay, you're a musician who gained some level of success, you know, you're part of that particular 1%, and to make myself feel better, I'm going to knock you fucking down a peg or two.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some of that going on, but yeah, people like knocking bands and artists down a peg or two, and that's probably fine a lot of times. That's probably healthy a lot of times, but sometimes it isn't, and sometimes it just leads to, yeah, a very you know, prescribed type of thinking on music, which is just boring, you know.
Yeah, like I definitely find, you know, all that like kind of like brainy critical analysis of music interesting, but I also feel, yeah, I also feel it also alienates me in a way as well, because I mean I don't just like ska, but you know, just the fact that ska is one of the things I like, it feels, the fact that that is so completely and thoroughly ignored by those people.
Yes.
It almost is like that weird poison pill thing where it's like, yeah, it's interesting what you're saying, but you know, you completely ignore this and on these other kinds of things that they just don't fit your.
Right. Fashion. It's fashion, which exposes the plot a little bit.
Yeah.
And I'm with you. I'm with you. I love good music criticism. I love, you know, I like to read stuff like that too, and music journalism is really important, and criticism is really important, all of that, and it's also just entertaining. Like I like to hear, yeah, we're probably both, I'm sure, like nerds that way, but that doesn't preclude this conversation that we're having either. It's the fertile ground that produces it, because, you know, like, of course, shit that isn't, you know, stuff that's not like in the canon, is going to be, yeah, at best ignored, and at worst, and it's not even the critics that I have the problem with so much as the people who take their opinions as like gospel or like a prescriptive way to appreciate art, like. That's the stuff that's sort of more annoying to me, and the stuff I have, and what I have fun, you know, lobbing water balloons at.
Yeah, because I also really appreciate the experience of people being exposed to music with no context at all.
Yeah,
and that was like, you know, being in a ska band before it got on MTV. That was an interesting experience because a lot of people had no context, no experience with this music before.
That's the best.
And then you and it almost every single time they'd be like, this is cool. Like,
yeah,
they had no baggage attached to it. Like, this is nerdy or this is uncool or yes, this is this or
yes,
that. So they just yes, enjoyed it. Maybe they didn't become huge fans, but they just enjoyed it. And then it became like a big MTV trend. And then it became now it's not mainstream anymore. So it's like an embarrassing trend that happened, you know, a few years ago. And that trying to expose people with it without that baggage was really challenging.
Yes, completely. And I mean, you know, it, same with movies and, you know, TV shows, whatever else, it's like, it's so much better when you see something and you haven't already been told exactly how to label it and exactly where to put it in your mind and exactly how to do the analysis. Like, all of that stuff gets in the way of, is an impediment to the goal for me of like art, which is getting to that dream, transcendent dream place. And same with me for, I mean, the way you just described the ska thing, you know, before the wave that blew up, like that was me discovering that Operation Ivy record. Same thing. I was like, what is this? This is, I had no idea where to put it. I didn't have any labels for it. Like, that part of my brain wasn't able to be active. So it was only the other part that was just expansive and, you know, like would just dream. And that component of mystery too, of not understanding it, like of being confused, like that's my shit. Like I want to be confused, you know, because
yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
So with Eve Six, have you over the years gone through that, some version of that, like having had a huge hit single early in your career and sort of that being baggage for you guys to, you know, move forward or present new music or to present yourselves as you exist now?
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
or has that been a good thing, or has it been a, I don't know, I guess it could be either.
No, it's a good question. I like the only sane perspective on it for me where I'm at now is, you know, to like, is not to run any counterfactuals and to be like, you know, see what was good about it. And a whole lot was good about it, like unquestionably good about it. You know, we were very young and we were very much, you know, that made us very much at the whims of producers, labels, and me, myself personally, of opinions within the band that differed from mine, you know, that when I didn't, at a time when I didn't have any equipment with respect to like how to deal with what's the fucking word, don't edit this out. I should be forced to what conflict, right? Like I didn't know how to do conflict, so I didn't. So I like retreated, drank, just kind of took my heart out of it. That's like kind of a short history of those first three records. I'm like at this point grateful for all of it because I like, yeah, find myself in this place where I'm making exactly the music I want to make in my fucking, I'm playing the most dignified form of music you can play after 40, which is punk rock. our new record isn't actually, I wouldn't call it a punk rock record. I wouldn't even call the EP one, but you know what I'm saying? It's a good line. We're able to do exactly what we want there, able to kind of like, yeah, in a way create our own little avant-garde world and keep the lights on playing rock, like none of which would have been possible without the very particular, in some ways predictable, in some ways not at all, strange career that I've had with all of its ups and downs, you know?
Yeah, it's what's interesting is that it seems like what has happened on Twitter and with your new music is that you've gained what's the word I'm looking for?
Don't edit this out.
Don't
no, yeah.
They have
yeah,
to know
this is like a feat of strength. We're gonna leave all this shit in.
Credibility, like a punk credibility, I guess, like you with like younger people and younger bands, like it seems to me that you have this fan base. It's not, it doesn't seem like it's a total rehash of your fans from back in the day. It's like a kind of like newer, younger people are totally down with you because of your authenticity on Twitter and the way you're approaching new music with that sort of like, fuck it, whatever, we'll just do whatever we want. And like,
and I'd go even as far as to say the production on the new EP.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds so much more stripped back than, you know, the earlier material.
Yeah.
Like some of the tones are like real, real weird. And
yeah,
I think that's really awesome.
Thank you. Yeah. I think that's true. And it's funny. But when you say, like punk cred or whatever.
I mean it in the not in the literal.
I know yeah. exactly what you mean, and and it's the same way I describe, like, when I say something or some record or some band or some person is cool, like, what I'm really saying is that it's honest. Like, you know, I mean, that's, they're synonyms to me. Like, and I think the term punk, to the chagrin of a lot of punks probably, is similar. Like, you know, it's, you said authenticity, and I think, like, I think it's that. And that's not to say that it's like, yeah, we're a rock and roll band, we're making rock records, and the thing I'm doing online, yes, it's honest, it's also performative, like, it's both. Like, there's but I think it resonates with people because they know that there's a background of honesty to all of this, and that is a thing that is kind of lacking culturally.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So you've played a couple shows, I think, since recently, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We just did a show just this past weekend in Michigan. And then we did one a few months ago in South Dakota.
So compare these couple of shows to what it was like, you know, last time you did shows, which was before COVID and before this Twitter thing.
Yeah.
Is it been a big difference, you know, like in terms of your own attitudes towards playing live, in terms of like how people are reacting to you or any of that stuff?
Yeah, it absolutely has informed the way that I engage with the band and even the songs live, to be honest. Like, this is going to sound funny, but like, in some ways I feel understood. Sounds so narcissistic, but in some ways I feel understood for the first time, because it's like, yeah, you know, people kind of know me. I feel like people know me a little bit now, whereas, like, you know, you sort of think, you know, like, before you have the hit record or whatever, like, oh, I want the hit record, then I'm gonna be loved and understood for who I am, blah, 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 blah. Narcissist dream, but, you know, all musicians are to some degree who devote their life to this thing. I think it's just, that's an aspect of it. Like, but of course the opposite happens. It's like, you know, and especially with a band like us and that came up so young and everything else. But I feel like, yeah, there's this wall has been kind of removed, and we've gained a completely new, you know, listenership in the last year or whatever also. And yeah, the show that we just did in Grand Rapids was fucking insane. It was like, and look, I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that people can go to shows again. And so it's like, you know, you don't know what you got till it's gone. People are like,
sure, yeah.
Oh, I'm fucking going out. I'm going to go see a show. Like, and I would assume that this is happening with all bands and not just bands who have gotten big online or whatever. yeah, there were like 5,000 people there. Like, it was crazy. And you know, it I don't know if every show is going to be like that. You know, I mean, that's always our band, you know, like, some years certain cities will just, like, just historically, the pre-Renaissance or whatever, will be good for us and some won't. But yeah, I mean, it's you know, there's definitely something going on here, you know.
Sure.
Was this the show that Mustard Plug played?
It was the show that Mustard Plug played, and I didn't realize that Mustard Plug was playing it until after they played. We got there, we had like crazy hell travel, and so, like, and then had a really early sound check, so we did our sound check and then went back to the hotel to take a nap, And when we got back, I learned that Mustard Plug had played. So I missed their set. But yeah, that's one of those, dude, that was one of those bills that you're talking about, honestly, because it was Mustard Plug, Eve Six, and Remo Drive, who are fucking great. A band from Minneapolis. Three completely different bands, you know, and everyone was stoked.
Nice.
So I would love to hear a little bit more about you described yourself as a Christian anarchist.
Right.
I would love to hear a little bit more about that philosophy.
Yeah. All right. Well, I was doing a little bit of hyperbole there. You know, there's culturally, and it's always, it's tricky to talk about like culture as a whole right now, because it's like, what is it? Because there is, you know, of course you have like, you know, MAGA Christians and like, you know, religious right Christians, and that like that whole brand of Christianity, which I would argue is actually Christianity's opposite. Like, I mean, that's not even, I don't think, controversial to any thinking person. Like, that's not it. That
yeah. Pretty different than what.
Pretty different. pretty different. And yeah, I think it, you know, Christ, the Christ figure, would he have been one of those people? Fuck no. Like, he was literally, yeah, I mean, he was an anarchist in some sense. Like, you know, it's kind of silly to try to like you know, apply today's politics to him, I guess. But yeah, in the other, in a large aspect of culture, there is, people find the notion of a God concept utterly repellent. It makes them furious. And I get that too. Like, I, you know, I was raised Catholic. I did have a lot of baggage coming out of that with just like, you know, to be honest, it wasn't even the Catholic stuff that did the most damage. It was like a brief stint at a Baptist church where they really hammered the fire and brimstone stuff. So I definitely went through my like predictable atheist watching Christopher Hitchens YouTube debates phase. I feel like that doesn't do it for me. that doesn't do it for me either. And of course, when we're talking about these things, we're talking about something very personal, not in the sense that this is personal, I don't want to talk about it, but in the sense that like spiritual stuff is literally experiential. So it's kind of hard to like articulate sometimes, but I find the God concept far more interesting. And it's, so it's something that I also talk about online because it's true, and because, yeah, it's also polemic, and I also enjoy that it's polemic. Like, I'm not gonna lie. both things are true. So yeah, I don't know if that made any sense, but that, sure, that's sort of where I'm coming from with that stuff. I do have, you know, I believe in God. I pray, but not in a way that people might think is prayer. but it is to me, like, and I'm also a sober alcoholic. So there's, you know, there's some of that at play here too, where part of my recovery is built on certain, yeah, spiritual principles. So all of that stuff informs the you know, a tweet like I'm a Christian anarchist.
I grew up, I was in a very, very fire and brimstone church, like pretty extreme to like where there was like speaking in tongues and all that stuff.
Yep.
For me, I went atheist in my 20s. And I took that route where I was really antagonistic and hateful towards faith.
Yeah.
But I've stayed atheist, but now I've made peace with other people's beliefs. And I have like, I'm not in the slightest bit threatened by whatever somebody believes. But I think I had to go through that period. I think it was more sort of claiming my own identity of my own belief to be kind of
totally
like push back on like, I have the right, my belief's right and you're wrong kind of thing. But then it's just like, whatever. I don't
completely.
I don't give a shit what you believe, you know, as long as you're not infringing on other people.
No, I completely understand that. And of course, like the actual stuff that interests me about like a spiritual life are almost like definitionally precluded from like the church in most respects. And, you know, and the politics and bureaucracy of organized religion, which yeah is crazy. Yeah, so I guess the thing that's sort of funny and maybe could be critiqued, maybe rightly so, about the way that I do that stuff online is, yeah, there is almost an element of hostility about it, like, but behind that there's joy and love. Like, yeah. You know, I'm not actually out here trying to like delegitimize anyone's worldview or God view or lack thereof. I'm just introducing, you know, maybe a different way to think about stuff. At least that's maybe the goal, you know?
Yeah. I appreciate that. I mean, it's interesting because I actually find incredible peace in the nothing. The nothing brings me peace. I think about this is where you and I differ. The fact that there's no God in my mind, the nothing,
dude,
there's nothing.
I remember peace. Having this exact conversation. Sorry to get so excited that I completely cut you off.
That no, that's fine.
Beautiful sentiment. But like, yeah, I remember having this exact conversation with someone in my 20s where I was like, you know, non-believers always say that like they wish they could believe in God. Wouldn't that be so great if they could believe in God? I was like, I wish I couldn't. Like, you know, like I wish it were possible for me not to get this despot out of my head, you know. And that's when I had the antagonistic relationship with the thing. But I don't think the way that this is the kind of thing that infuriates atheists, because I realize that I'm sort of diluting the water here with more water, but but that there might not be as much difference as one might think between your observation and the relief that you feel from the nothingness and mine and the relief that I feel from the God concept. Because I'm not talking about a guy in the sky. You know what I mean? Yeah. I'm talking about the ineffable.
Yeah. I don't think there's that big of a difference. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a kind of what you call it and everything. Yep. Like that. Yeah. All right. That concludes our conversation about ska.
Cool.
You guys, this has been my favorite podcast I've done. This has been fucking
right on.
Fantastic. So thank you so much for having me on and just being good at your jobs. This was really, really cool.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thanks for being such a good guest.
Thank you so much for listening to In Defense of Ska. If you've enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to the show wherever you normally download podcasts. If you haven't already, grab a copy of my book, In Defense of Ska, available at clashbooks.com.
You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. It's at In Defense of Ska. You can also sign up for my newsletter at aaroncarnes.substack.com. You will get the podcast sent directly to your inbox every Wednesday. In Defense of Ska would not be possible without the great team that tirelessly works on it every week. So you should go check out their other projects as well. Co-host Adam Davis has a great band called Omnigon. Give them a follow on Instagram. It's simply at Omnigon. And our editor, Chris Reeves, has a phenomenal record label and podcast called Ska Punk International. For more information, go to skapunkinternational.com. And on that note, we leave you by saying, ska now more than ever. Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.